Welcome, everyone, to the Perceptive Podcast. My name is Josh Placer, the owner of Game Wisdom, and we got a great cast for you this week. Ken, unfortunately, is busy, so I've called in fan of the site, Lorsen Poirier, as substitute co-host.
Hello, thanks for inviting me.
Yep, Lorsen, it's great to have you back on.
Oh, thank you. I always love coming and helping out in the podcast. It's always a lot of fun.
Yep, and we got some great topics this week. So right now we are casting on Saturday, and BlizzCon is currently going on, and there's been a few big announcements from it. Blizzard, of course, announced their basically competitor to Team Fortress called Overwatch. It's a game that's built on the assets of their canceled MMO Titan, and it's pretty much looking like a direct competitor. You've got like very cartoony characters. They are going for a little bit more, I guess, in terms of depth, with each character having vastly different skills and controls. And it looks interesting, but at this point, we don't know how it's going to turn out. So, Lorsen, as a fan of TF2, what do you make of Overwatch?
Well, at first, I was pretty excited by the character designs. And then I'll just explain this. When I first saw Overwatch, it was through, it was the YouTube video where it introduced all the characters. Mm-hmm. And so I didn't exactly know it was a TF2 clone, so I'm watching it, and the first person you see, I think, is Tracer, mm-hmm. which is, I guess you could say the direct competitor to, like, the Scout, mm-hmm. and the overall style and feel of the overall style and the movement of the game and, like, the shooting and stuff looked awesome. I was like, oh, this looks like a great, like, sci-fi FPS MMO, and I'm like, I'm totally all for that. And all the characters have like very specific things that make them unique. Like I said, the Tracer, she can do this thing where she can teleport back to where her previous position was like 3 seconds prior, and that's like very interesting because she can take down like a tank character that has like a shield, and it was pretty awesome. I was like, wow, like mm-hmm. that's totally something like I would play, and like I main Scout in TF2. And so I hadn't made the connection yet. And then as it went along, like, there's a sniper, and then there's another sniper. Like, one uses, like a bow and arrow, another one uses, like, a gun. Mm-hmm. And then there's the engineer who can drop down a sentry and uses a wrench to fix it. And so as it went along, it looked really cool, but I was starting to kind of get less and less impressed because with the overall color scheme of the game, it made it look really, really busy. Mm-hmm. And it's very, very distracting. Like, with TF2, it's, like, essentially the same, like, four or five colors. There's brown, red, blue, green, and mm-hmm. then gray. And so, like, things stick out. Like, the characters are meant to stick out so you can find them, where on this, it looked like the characters could blend right in with some of the backgrounds.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And overall, it was sort of confusing to watch the video because while I'd be watching, like, you would see, I think, in one of the engineers' point of views, you can see, like, three or four characters, but then, like, they all get lost at one point, and they all reappear again.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking with Overwatch. Looking at it, it has a very cel shade or very stylized art style to it, similar to TF2, and it does look like things can get very chaotic. And, I mean, I've been watching TF2 and played a little bit myself, and it can get very hard to follow what's going on, especially when you throw in, you know, all the different hats and outfits. Things can sort of just bleed together in just, like, one mess of explosions.
Oh, absolutely. Like, you throw in a couple of soldiers with a cow mangler in there, and that's it. Like, you pretty much cannot follow the game. And that's a game that pays really good attention to details mm-hmm. in the background, so they do all look the same so that characters stick out. Mm-hmm. And it is, and that's probably my, right now, like, as seeing the video, because it is a video, not like a real demo that you can play or anything. It just, right now, it seems extremely busy, and it felt a bit more like Call of Duty or Quake. Like, it looked like the game is a bit more fast-paced with TF2.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, like, with TF2, when you shoot something, sure, health can go down fast, but health tends to go down a bit slower, so the battles are a bit longer, where, like, in those games, they tend to be a bit quicker. And mm-hmm. so I feel like it's a bit more fast-paced, and with it being busy, I think it's going to be kind of a hot mess at first.
Mm-hmm.
That is my impression.
Yep, and I think with Blizzard, it'll be interesting to see just how they're going to take it. Because as we saw with Diablo 3, they went with a very different direction from the story, and then they sort of had to retread that ground with patch 2.0 and removing the auction house and stuff like that. And it's sort of kind of funny when you think about that. World of Warcraft has been this dominating force so for over 5 years, it's going to be 10 years in November, and this month, and people have been trying to catch up to it. And now Blizzard is trying to catch up to Valve with TF2. And, you know, Valve has been doing TF2 now for, how long has it been? I think it's been at least 5-6 years at this point, maybe even more.
7.
Damn.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Game's old.
Yeah. Well, yeah, these games are definitely getting old. And with Team Fortress, I mean, we've talked about before we came onto the cast, but Valve has, you know, spent a long time on refining and basically carefully laying this foundation for TF2 down. And it is a completely different game now than it was 7 years ago, but you can always tell that they have a very clear goal as to what they want from the game and what they want to expand on it.
Yeah, TF2 as a whole is always evolving. Like, mm-hmm. And they're always like trying to, and well, not that they're always trying to change stuff, but like the gameplay is different as new items get released. Like how you can play a character can completely change. Whereas from a demo, from being like the big spearhead with a sticky bomb launcher, you become a demo knight and go and flank. Or you know, if you're really good, you can still just go ahead and be a spearhead. But now the medic just doesn't follow you at that point.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So. Yep. And we'll be definitely interesting to see what they're going to do with it. I know their the Dota inspired game, I think Heroes of the Swarm or something, Heroes of the Storm, something like that, is going to be coming out soon. And that is Blizzard's attempt at moving in on the MOBA market, you know, against Dota 2 and League of Legends. They have Hearthstone, which is their casual slash, you know, competitive CCG game. And just as a brief aside, that was also announced at BlizzCon that there will be an expansion to Hearthstone coming out in December. I think it's called Goblins versus Gnomes or something like that. Or Goblins versus Dwarfs, whatever that is. But they're going to add, you know, another 100 or so cards to the game. And right now, as we're recording, the world champion of Hearthstone is being played. So, I mean, Blizzard is one of those companies. They have so many, you know, irons in the oven. They just really can create these great IPs and these brands. And, I mean, with World of Warcraft, I can't even count how much money they've actually made off of that in the 10 years it's been out.
Like, with the monthly subscription and the expansion packs and
I mean, they
everything else that ties in, like shirts.
Yep. I mean, just with subscriptions alone, they had, like, over 10 million subscribers at $15 a month for years. And I mean, even at the cost of having people to maintain the servers and work on the game, they're still making so much money. And the same goes for Valve with Steam and TF2. And since Valve is not a publicly traded, they don't have to report their earnings each year. But it's safe to say that Valve is not going to be running out of money anytime soon.
Oh, absolutely not. Even with just me still playing TF2, the amount of money I spend on keys and tickets, like...
You're keeping Valve going. Thank you, Lorsa.
Oh, yeah. Everyone, you are welcome.
Mm-hmm. All right, with Blizzard news out of the way, I want to go to my first bit of news I found interesting this week, and that is regarding Nintendo. They recently had their latest Nintendo Direct video, where basically the head of Nintendo and key members talk about upcoming news and promotions. And this is the first time that they started to expand on the Amiibo line. Now, the Amiibo line, for those of you who don't know, is Nintendo's attempt at capturing the toys-to-life market that Spyro, Skylanders, and Disney Infinity are currently pretty much in control of. So, the Amiibo line is set to come out by the end of November. It's going to tie into Smash Bros. For the Wii U. And they basically have the Series 1 figures done. So, of course, it'll be Mario, Luigi, Link, and so on and so forth. So, the Nintendo Direct actually started to talk about what they're planning on expanding on it with. Originally, they were just saying it was going to be, you put the character on, you basically get like a little AI guy who fights for you in Smash Bros. So, with the video, they start to announce, like, with games like Hyrule Warriors, if you put, like, the Link Amiibo on, you get, like, a unique item. Put other characters on, you get bonuses in-game. And with Mario Kart 8, they're also going to have, like, Mii costumes of different characters. And that kind of stuff I'm not really interested in, because I just never found pure cosmetic stuff all that rewarding to me. I'm more of a gameplay guy. But they have started to hint that upcoming games like the new Kirby game, I think a new Yoshi game, will have amiibo support. And this is where things get really interesting for the amiibo, because it's not being tied to a specific game. It's basically being tied to Nintendo's entire franchise line. So it gives them a lot more room to grow, but at the same time, there's nothing really concrete to it that makes me want to, you know, run out and buy them all as someone would for Disney Infinity. Now, I know when we talked about this with E3 earlier this year, I know you, Orson, weren't exactly too thrilled about the amiibo line, right?
No, and I'm still just as disappointed as I was back then.
Mm-hmm. And I'm interested because I'm a hardcore Nintendo fan from, you know, way back in the 80s. So there's this part of me that wants to buy them all, but again, I'm still waiting to hear something more out of it. And while they have announced a little bit, it's still not, I think, enough meat to it. And this is sort of where I think Nintendo has a, you know, rock and a hard place type situation. If they want to expand it, then they obviously need to say, hey, you buy these figures, we're going to give you, you know, unique levels, unique game options. But at the same time, then there are going to be people complaining, oh, you know, the amiibos are just, you know, expensive DLC that I'm forced to buy. And I think they will have to decide, similar to how they had to basically decide whether or not the Wii was going to be branded as a casual machine or a hardcore machine, what market they want to focus on with it.
It just, like, hearing this, like, I'm literally just sitting here, like, shaking my head, just listening to it, like, because, like, this comes to the problem where, like, when you say, like, it's expensive DLC, where I can just imagine running through a game and then seeing a chest, but then seeing it behind a gate, and, mm-hmm. like, you need the, what is it, amiibo?
Amiibo.
Amiibo, like, you're going to need one to unlock it. And then, like, I can just see, like, how, like, mm-hmm. like, I can just see the potential, like, how they could take it and they could make it so it can be something to easily hate mm-hmm. with something as simple as that. Like, because, again, like, it's kind of cool, like, I can get, like, the idea itself, I think, is all right. I think how they're, like, doing it and, like, putting in Smash Brothers, putting in Hyrule, like, Warriors, like, mm-hmm. that's fine. But I'm just, it's tiring to hear it's just for the same stuff that, like, I'm, like, the same IPs we always hear from, Mario, mm-hmm. Zelda, Smash Brothers.
You know, they have announced that they are looking into maybe having third-party developers make use of amiibo. That would be interesting because one of the things about the Disney Infinity and the Skylanders is that they are locked to their respective brands. So if Nintendo could leverage other developers, you know, like Platinum Games and, wow, I can't think of any other third-party developers off the top of my head, that could be a way for them to make it unique. And I think that's what Nintendo really needs at the moment, is they need more things to make them stand out and be different from the Xbox One and the PlayStation 4.
Oh, definitely. Like, when you say that, like, I could see them, like, maybe instead of having it be, like, a DLC, maybe, like, a reskin, like, maybe, well, I wouldn't want a reskin either, but, mm-hmm. like, possibly, like, if they, okay, how I would be interested with this would be if they had the amiibo, like, let's say they had set lines, right, mm-hmm. and then in a game, like, that came out later down the road, like, you could use those amiibos to, like, for that game as well, mm-hmm. instead of having to go out and, like, buy a new one,
mm-hmm.
kind of have it so, like, as long as the game senses that it's there, that you do have it,
mm-hmm.
that, like, it can unlock something within the game, but, like, not something that's, like, groundbreaking or something that's, like you say, like, a whole new level, because that, mm-hmm. that I think is ridiculous, mm-hmm. but I would want there to be something more than just, like, a hat for, like, a game, you
mm-hmm.
know?
Yeah.
For, like, one game. Like, I would want it to be, like, for everything. So, like, if the Zelda one works in Hyrule Warriors and works in Super Smash Brothers and then worked in, like, a game down the road, like, that would be pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
And then it would give it more of, like, a value, something to, like, have and keep on using versus, okay, I bought it for this game and now I've got to go buy this other one for another game. Mm-hmm. Like,
yeah, and that's... It sounds like that's what they're trying to do with this, give these characters a lot more value than just from one game or one property. But at the same time, they've already announced that certain figures will not work with certain games. And I think someone put up a chart on Polygon showing which Series 1 figures will work for which games. So it can be a little bit confusing unless you're just, you know, the absolute hardcore Nintendo fan buys them all, then you're pretty much set.
Right, and there's definitely still a lot of diehard fans out there,
mm-hmm.
for sure, that will do that. Like, definitely a lot of adults.
Yeah. I mean, look at the Disney Infinity line and Skylanders and how crazy they went with that. And I was talking to someone a few days ago. I mean, Infinity is really set to become huge when they start adding in, you know, Marvel. And I got money down that they're going to probably put Star Wars in that at some point since Disney owns LucasArts.
Mm-hmm. I can see that.
I mean, hell, I can't imagine how much money they made when they put the Frozen characters in it after that movie became so popular.
Or how many kids actually wanted to now have Disney Infinity because of it. Because mm-hmm. they wanted to play with Anna and Elsa.
Yep. And same thing with, you know, the Marvel characters, same thing with Star Wars. And I know they just announced the Big Hero 6 movie that just came out. They already have characters from that Infinity coming. So, I mean, it's pretty much a positive feedback loop of movie becomes popular, becomes an Infinity character, which makes Infinity more popular. And, I mean, that's probably going to be one of, like, the most well-designed best uses of an IP we're going to see for a long time.
Yeah, I think I can agree with you on that one.
Mm-hmm. So, I guess just wrapping up talking about the Amiibo, as I said, it's going to be coming out at the end of the month with Smash Brothers, and I'm still debating with myself if I want to get, because again, I'm a huge Nintendo fan, and maybe just having the figures, you know, display would be nice, but until I hear more details about what it's going to do for future games, I'm still a little apprehensive about it.
And what makes you apprehensive?
That it's just going to be, I'm going to spend, I think there's like 7 figures, $12 a figure, so about $84 on, you know, stuff that will be unlock a hat in this game or unlock something for a Mii in another game. I've never been big on the whole Mii, you know, online or profile type thing. Same thing with, you know, the Xbox avatars and stuff like that. I just want stuff that will make the games better. I don't really care about whether some online avatar of mine has a fancy hat or new clothes.
You definitely don't fit in the TF2 culture.
Yeah. Thankfully, or I would be broke by now, probably. And I'm just glad Skylanders came out this decade, or back in 2008, 2009, rather than 10 years before that. When I was younger, I would have, you know, gone bankrupt buying all those figures.
What is it, like, I think I read an article, like, a year or two ago, where it's like, for all of Skylanders, it was already like you had to spend over $1,000 to have them all at that point.
Oh, God.
Yeah, and there's only been more and more and more stuff released as time went on.
Yeah. I think in February, they made, like, I think a few billion dollars off of the franchise.
Oh, God.
So, I mean, in short time, like, only like 2-3 years, they've already passed the billion-dollar mark in terms of profit for it.
Well, whoever thought Skylanders was going to be a good idea was one smart man, that's for sure.
Yep. I've been trying to get a hold of the guy. He worked on one of my favorite games, Star Control 2, and I can't get a hold of him, unfortunately, but I would love to talk to him about it.
Probably counting all his money.
Yeah. Or coming up with more figures to make parents, you know, wallow over for the next holiday season.
Oh, most likely. We always have, from where I work at the store I work at, we always have a Skylander display up, like a really, really nice one. And it is the nicest display we have out back in the electronics department.
Nice.
So.
Yep, and that's going to pull in so many people, especially we got Black Friday coming up by the end of the month.
Oh, yeah, I'm opening. It's going to be fun.
Oh, God. Good luck. All right, so with that, let's move from news. And let's talk about some of the games we've played. And for this week, we've actually both been playing the same game. And that is The Binding of Isaac Rebirth. Now, The Binding of Isaac was one of my pretty much all-time favorite games. I spent close to, I think, a little over 80 hours playing the original and the expansion. Now, this was the game developed by Edmund McMillen, the developer for Team Meat, who also did Super Meat Boy. And it's a top-down action roguelike game. You have your little character Isaac, and you're exploring these dungeons that are randomly generated, and you find items that basically alter how he plays in some way. You may find an item that makes your attacks do more damage, maybe one that slows it down, even you got some that turns him into a boomerang that he shoots out and then comes back around. And so by the end of each play, your character will be radically different each time, and that sort of lends itself into your strategy for playing. And the genius of the game is how they incorporate achievements into game progression. every achievement in the game unlocks a new item, enemy, or something that gets added into the randomization for subsequent games. So on your 15th run through the game, it's going to be different than your second run or your 30th run. Now with Rebirth, this is what's considered the quote-unquote definitive edition of the game. It was priced a little bit higher than the original, and what they've done is they've added in new ways to heal your character, there's new characters, enemies, bosses, challenges, updated graphics engine, new music, etc.
Lots of bug fixes too.
Yeah, and it's pretty much the Binding of Isaac, but a lot fancier. And that's both good and bad for me because, like I said, I've spent 80 hours on the original. So I 100% got my money's worth on that. So going into playing Rebirth, I do get that sense of deja vu playing it because I just spent so much time on it. But for people new to the game, this is definitely the version to get. There's just so much new stuff, especially for someone going into it fresh. Now, Lorson, did you play the original Binding of Isaac?
Oh, yeah. I spent over 200 hours in the original Binding of Isaac.
Mm-hmm. So what do you think about Rebirth, having playing it now?
Well, when I first saw Rebirth, I saw the updated graphics, and I wasn't so sure about it because I liked how cutesy the Flash version was.
Mm-hmm.
And I absolutely love it. Like, I had to get used to the controls because the controls were smoother, and I mm-hmm. felt like Isaac was faster.
Yeah.
Or maybe the game just responded better because it wasn't made in Flash. Like, that could have happened too. Mm-hmm. But I ended up dying a lot my first couple of run-throughs. Like, I couldn't even beat the first boss. But once I got the hang of the new feel, the game is completely great. Like,
mm-hmm.
100%, like, this is what it should have been. Mm-hmm. Like, this is what, like, a really good game is.
Yeah.
Is this game right here.
Mm-hmm. Yep, and as I said, it's basically more of everything. So, for those of you listening, if you love the original Binding of Isaac, you're going to pretty much fall in love again with Rebirth. The only thing that sucks for me is now I have to have the task of going through and getting all my achievements back. Because I got like 99% of the achievements in Binding of Isaac done. I did all the avoid damage ones. Those are a pain in the ass to do. Because every time I do it, once you start thinking about it, then you start getting a lot more nervous. And then you start messing up.
Oh, yeah. Did you ever beat Satan in the original game?
Yeah.
Like, you know, like the final boss, Shoal?
Yeah.
Satan? Oh, my God. My fourth run through in Rebirth, like, I beat the game, right? And then my fifth run through, I was at, like, the final boss in Nutero, mm-hmm. and I was given the option to drop down to Shoal mm-hmm. or finish the level. And I was like, you know what? Let's just do it. So I get to Shoal, and this is the first time I've ever actually made it to him.
Mm-hmm.
And I lost with him on his third form at only, like, a quarter of his life left. And after that, I've never been able to get past Mom.
Yeah. Oh, you're going to love this. Last night, I got to him. I got him down to one hit left, and then I got hit by one of those leech things, and it killed me.
Oh, God.
He was literally one hit away from dying, and I got killed.
The struggle is real. The struggle is so real.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things they've done is they've also made the character screen a lot more. They made the UI a lot better. Now it shows you your progress with each of the characters. Before, it was hinted at in the achievements, but not told explicitly in-game that by beating each of the game's challenges with each character would unlock new items. So if you beat the game, you beat Mom, you beat Saiyan, you beat the hidden character. There's actually a hidden area that they unlock with the previous expansion, Wrath of Lamb. If you can beat mm-hmm. that gets you something new. And there's now a new boss rush mode. Have you seen that one yet?
No, because I want to try to beat the game as much as possible first and get all the characters unlocked before I do the challenges.
Yeah. Yeah, the boss rush is actually unlocked if you do it well enough in the main game. It becomes available after you beat Mom. And when you go in there, you basically have to fight pairs of every boss in the game. And it's just insane to do. I did it once just by luck, but you really need to have a great build for that to have a chance at. And last night I posted a picture, I got this like combination of all these new items that made my guy so strong. I have a charge, so it takes about 5 seconds to attack before I can actually do anything. But when I hit something, it's almost a one-hit kill on every boss in the game. And it was
Oh, man.
It was just hilarious. So like go up against like Mom, to do my charge, I took her down to like an eighth of her health bar in one hit. And I'm just like, oh yeah, this is nice. But again, this goes back to what I said a few minutes ago. All these items radically change how your play will go. And that's what makes the Binding of Isaac such a well-designed game. So in another run, I may get an item that makes my guy float. So then I won't have to worry about obstacles, but I may have a weaker attack. So I would have to plan around that more, as opposed to last time where I'm just, you know, walking death, but I still have to deal with the obstacles.
And what makes Binding of Isaac so great is, especially Rebirth, because of all the new items, is that kind of thing, like, when you're picking up all the new items, and it changes your stats, so you have, like, a whole new way of playing the game, mm-hmm. even if you had just, like, made it, like, halfway through, and you're at the last boss, you now gotta adjust to this last item pickup.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I absolutely love about it. It's always, like, on the toes, and you always have to, like, be ready.
Mm-hmm.
But let's talk about the best feature of Rebirth, and that is that you can exit out of a game in the middle of a run, and you can return to it when you start it back up.
Yeah, that is really nice. The original...
Instead of having to have it, like, sit there and run if you, like, have to go to work and then come back and finish playing it,
mm-hmm.
if you're in, like, the middle of the best run of your life.
Yep, I was surprised. It actually worked in the middle of a boss fight that bugged out. I thought I would have to restart again, so I exiled, and then when I started up again, I was right back at that boss, and it was working again. And the game now has save files, so you can have multiple profiles. And as you said, Lorson, it just is what Binding of Isaac should have been originally. Just a lot of refinement, a lot of additions to it. And I think I'll probably am going to spend maybe another 60, 70 plus hours on this one.
Oh, easily. Easily. This game is so much fun, and there's always so much to do.
Mm-hmm. I heard that they are thinking about doing more DLC and more content for it as time goes on, so that'll be interesting. Because right now, they've already had everything from the original, plus the expansion, plus Rebirth's new stuff. So it will be cool to see where they're going to take it, add more bosses, and of course, add a lot more achievements to it.
I'm down for that. I'm totally okay, because Binding of Isaac isn't like a $60 game. Mm-hmm. Like, this is a game I can definitely spend money on, especially with how much time I've spent in it. Like, it's 100% worth it.
Mm-hmm. And it's another great example of a developer taking something that worked and making it better, similar to what the FTL developers did when they expand on that with the Advance Edition.
What did the Advance Edition do? Because I only played the stock.
It added in new ships, new enemy ship the ship blueprints that you'll have to fight, new events, new weapons, stuff like that. I think the same final boss, or I think they may have made it even harder.
That's fair. I still have not beaten FTL.
Yeah, I've only been able to beat it on easy. I can't do it on normal.
Let's not even talk about how far I can't get in normal.
And speaking of difficulty level, Binding of Isaac Rebirth also has difficulty settings. So you can play the game on either normal, which is, I think, considered like easy from the original. Excuse me. Or you can play on hard, which feels a lot more like the original. You have less items. It's a lot harder to get Isaac properly geared up on that mode.
Oh, yeah. Like, I tried difficult. Like, after I beat normal, I wanted to see if I could do, and after my failed Satan attempt, I wanted to see if I could do it on difficult. And I feel like it's a little bit harder than the original. Like,
yeah, me too.
The item drops. I want to say they must have just dropped how often they dropped in luck. Like, they had to have dropped luck, because I have mm-hmm. never found anything good. Like, it took me, I think, 5 attempts before I could get past the first boss, because I didn't have any weapons, and they were mm-hmm. all extremely difficult.
Yeah.
All the ones I got. Like, I was having trouble going against Dingle.
Oh,
like,
no.
Because when he charges, like, you don't have a speed stat. Like, I couldn't dodge it, because I'm right next to him.
Yeah, I hate Dingle. It's such a pain in the ass fight, just because of how quick he can move. And then it can just be difficult to track these guys. And there's a lot of other bosses that have that same speed. I know the spider enemies are very annoying because of that.
They're the worst ones in the game. Except for that one that's like the giant zombie head.
Mm-hmm.
That one's definitely the worst. If you don't have a piercing shot or you're not a ghost.
Yeah. I love how we're saying this stuff. And probably people listening have no idea what we're talking about. You know, floating heads, piercing, you can turn into a ghost. And that's another interesting thing they added, is you can make basically deals with the devil, or you get divine intervention help. If you do well enough on the floor, you'll get either an angel or devil room unlocked that can give you something. And the Devil Room have, like, very powerful items, but you have to give up your health to use them. And there's some really good stuff in there. Like, there's one that costs 2 hearts that turns you into a floating ghost. All your shots automatically pierce. And it's great, but it costs you permanently 2 points of health.
But that is definitely the best, like, one of the best items in the game. Like, So as long as you're not playing Kane in its first level, you always get it. Like, that's my rule. Get that, or if it's second level and you haven't gotten, like, a tier upgrade yet, I always pick up Little Bobby or Sister Maggie every time.
And there's one item that turns your... Oh, we forgot to tell everyone this. For those of you who haven't played Binding of Isaac, his whole attack is that he attacks by crying at people. This is not a happy-go-lucky game, if you haven't figured that out by now. You know, when we're talking about you're fighting the devil, you're fighting mom in the womb. This is not a PG-13 game, by the way.
Oh, no, this is definitely, like you have to be extremely mature and you have to be okay with gore, because the game's about child abuse, unfortunately.
Yeah.
But it does it very well. It does it very well. It's not like, done untastefully or in a very... like, oh, let's just make it about this. It was very well thought out.
Yeah, but all the items, a lot of them basically maim or mutilate Isaac to change his attacks. So, like, one thing will basically make him give him Ebola, and then he'll touch an enemy and it will do damage. Or he'll get, like, something, toothpicks that he'll stick to keep his eyes open. Now his attacks do double damage.
I was actually going to suggest that because that's one of my favorite items. I love toothpicks, but it's really sad.
Yep. And the beauty of the art style is that each item has a basically a graphical effect on Isaac, but it's basically localized to certain parts. So maybe one thing will just change his eye graphics, or one will change his legs or his chest. So when you get all these items put together, he's just like this amalgamation of different upgrades by the end of the game.
Or you get pills and one does puberty, or I ate pills. Those are always good. Good side effects.
And a lot of Isaac, and what makes it work so well, is that it does have a huge luck factor built into the whole roguelike design. As I said, all the levels are randomly generated. All the enemy encounters are generated. Bosses will be different each time you play through. And then when you get further into the game and you beat enough times, you unlock harder mode. Or a harder variant, now you'll start seeing more elite enemies. These are basically enemies who are a different color, but they'll have, like, some very unique perk to it based on that color. So, like, enemies who are black will explode when you kill them, so if they're too close to you, they'll do additional damage. Enemies that are blue will explode in, like, a explosion of bullets, and which surprised the hell out of me the first time I saw it. And all this is basically designed to keep the game from being stale. And I think it works so well at making each run a very different feel to it.
That's the great thing about it, because there's also so much to unlock that even if you have beaten the games a couple of times, there's, like right now, I'm pretty sure I've replayed the game, like, not beaten it, of course, but I've played it between 30 and 50 times by now, and each time I've gotten different items. Like, I may have picked up the same ones, but each run there was something new. Something new to try out, a new pill to try. Encountering new room loadouts, which are always fun times.
And the pills in the game are probably the most rogue-like-ish element of Binding of Isaac. The pills themselves, there's a set list for all the different effects pills will give you, but the pills are different each time. So in one game, all blue pills may give you increased speed. Next time you play them, all blue pills may lower your health by one each time you take it. And you won't know what they do until you pop one of those pills. So it really is like the slot machine of, do I want to risk it? But some of the pill effects are really amazing. And there's an item that makes it so you only get good pill effects. And that can be, game-breaking if you get a lot of pills during that run. But again, because of the randomization, you never know how your strategy is going to play out by the end of the game.
Exactly, and then something that they fixed in Rebirth that was kind of brokenly rampant in the normal game was if you got like a D6 or a T20 and you found an arcade room and you had a lot of money on you, especially if you were Kane, you had very, very good luck getting a lot of items and being able to reroll them. And if you had like Lucky Foot or if you had a PhD, which was an item, PhD is an item that allows you to only get positive pill effects. Mm-hmm. You could pick up pills that would give you health up.
Mm-hmm.
So you could essentially break your health bar by putting more hearts than you've ever had before on there just through pills effects alone. And then you could go through the game essentially and not worry about even destroying enemies. You could just run into them and make it to bosses and get through them because you would have like an infinite HP, which now in Rebirth, it's only 12. Mm-hmm. You're maxed out at 12 hearts now, which is probably a good thing because I know I abused that when I got the chance one time.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the best run I've ever had.
Yeah, and they now have new hearts. Basically, your health can be made up of different types of hearts. So you have like your normal health. And you have holy hearts, which are like these blue, like blue hearts. That's basically extra health that doesn't refill. You have like divine hearts. That if you keep a half of the heart and you make it through the end of the level, you get a new permanent health. And then there's now, I guess, evil hearts that if you lose that heart, it basically kills everything in the room for you. So it's definitely a lot more ways, a lot more variations to the game. Now, here's a question for you, Larson. What character do you like the most to play as?
I actually liked playing as Eve in the original, mm-hmm. and right now I only have Isaac and Cain, mm-hmm. and I do like running Isaac because he's just so cute.
I like, is Cain the one with the lucky foot, I think?
Yeah, the one with the lucky stat.
Yeah, I like him just because of the luck factor, obviously. I like Samson. They changed his ability that now every time he kills an enemy on a floor, his tier stat grows a little bit more with each death. And then that gets reset at the end of the floor as opposed to the end of the room. So he's a lot stronger now than the original.
Which one's stronger than the original?
Samson. Yeah.
Oh, I'm kind of glad I spaced out when you said that because I still haven't unlocked him. And I want to know what, like, I want to know how much better he is since the original because mm-hmm. Samson's terrible.
Yeah. And there's a new guy, Azrael, who's basically like a floating demon. So he gets flight from the start. He has like a short range puke attack. You have to get him by making 3 deals with the devil in a single game.
Oh my god, I want to unlock him. How do you unlock that one?
Which one, the Azrael?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you basically have to go into 3 devil rooms and buy an item each time.
Okay.
Yeah, and it's just a really great experience just to play through this game. I mean, we could probably sit here and talk about it for another hour going through all the potential strategies and the runs we've had.
Oh, definitely. And we already talked about this before we even started the podcast.
All right. I guess with that, I pretty much have nothing more to say about Binding of Isaac Rebirth. Definitely, if you are on the fence about it and you love the original, or you were interested in it but didn't play the first one, this is the version to get and a great game all around.
100%. 100%. Try it out if you can stand a little bit of gore. It's really good.
Gore and a lot more. Definitely not a game to be playing with the kids around. There's no cursing in it, but yeah, this is not exactly the cleanest looking game, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, it's pretty graphic. Mm-hmm. Like, blood everywhere, you can wear a goat's head.
Mm-hmm. And that's just the normal stuff we're talking about. We're not going to talk about some of the later stuff you see in that game.
Mm-hmm.
I think with that, let's move on to our big topic this week. And this is one that's very interesting, especially as we're talking more and more about digital games and updating stuff. And that has to do with both collectability and backwards compatibility or game preservation. One of the things about the video game industry that's very interesting is that unlike other industries where the most popular stuff becomes the highest price, here we see a lot of our games that do really well become heavily discounted over time. The value basically is not there. With rare exception, and I've talked about this on previous casts, companies like Nintendo, Blizzard, and maybe even like Activision with Call of Duty, their games keep their high price tag for a very long time. But for everyone else, even the games that make, you know, Game of the Year awards, stuff like Saints Row, the value just depreciates very quickly. Case in point with Saints Row 4, I just bought the whole, you know, super fancy collector's edition of it for $12 over the last sale they just had on it. And this was a game that was originally priced at $60, probably close to $100 after the game was, you know, with all the DLC. And this also goes back to the topic of game preservation, in how, because of how quickly the game industry moves, a lot of people really don't care about preserving games. We've talked about how Sony and Microsoft both really don't have systems in place to easily play, you know, PlayStation 2, PlayStation 1 era games. Microsoft, you know, I don't think they support Xbox on Xbox One. I'm not sure if they do 360. I think they do, but I'm not 100%. The only company that really believes in backwards compatibility, at least from the console side, is Nintendo. The Wii was, of course, able to play GameCube games. Wii U has the whole virtual console, so you can play NES up to N64 on it. And it's one of those things that, again, I get to sound really old. I know on our 2-year anniversary, I think you, Larson, you called me the old man at age of 29.
Yep.
But again, yeah, that's really true with the game industry. You can be really, you can feel really old, especially with how much things have changed. So for you, Larson, as someone who's younger and got into the game industry a lot further along into it than I did, what are your thoughts on basically backwards compatibility or preserving these video games?
I think it's extremely important. Just as the Library of Congress saves books, mm-hmm. and they save movies, and I don't know if they save music. Mm. I don't know if they do that, but I think it's extremely important to that even though video games are something that's a form of entertainment, it's also a form of art, regardless mm-hmm. of how much games may lack like really content, you mm-hmm. could say, like intellectual content. But in my opinion, it's just as important as preserving as pieces of artwork by mm-hmm. famous painters from the Renaissance. Mm-hmm. I think, especially in this era, it's extremely easy to back up at least one copy of the game mm-hmm. and keep it somewhere well preserved. I also I believe that that should happen, that there should be like a library video game, so if anything ever happened or mm-hmm. whatever, that there's still a copy out there. Mm-hmm. I also believe that once we move on to a new console, that everything from the previous console, or at least the one back from it, should be put up and should be accessed to download. Mm-hmm. That is just like a personal belief of mine. There's probably lots of reasons why we can't do that, blah, blah, blah. I don't care. Mm-hmm. my opinion is Super Nintendo and Nintendo, that's all dead at this point. There's no more development for it. Mm-hmm. Put all those games that they have, throw them up online, throw them up on the Wii Store, and then have them available for download for people. Mm-hmm. I don't see the big deal in that. And that way, everyone has access to it. Everyone can play it if they want to. Mm-hmm. I do know there are some people that, as they talk about, people probably around your age, as they grow older, and they're like, well, we want to have kids, and we want them to play video games as much as we do. They're like, well, I want to start them on some good games. And, they'll start it on stuff, and they'll talk about, saying, well, I want them to play these games from these consoles, and go up onto this, mm-hmm. and in my opinion, it would just make it easier instead of having to preserve these terrible cartridges. As much as I love them, I collect my favorite titles, so I have everything that I want. I have a list of what I'm still looking for, mm-hmm. So I have physical copies of them. But I can just as easily go online and download an illegal copy of it. Mm-hmm. But I already forgot where I was going with this. I forgot what I just said.
About physical copies, about preserving for younger generations.
Yeah, I think everyone should be able to easily experience all these games. I know Sony for a while was putting up older games on the PlayStation 4 or the PlayStation 3 for able to download.
Yeah, they still have that on PlayStation. It's on the PSN network, but they have a lot of PS2 and older games available to buy and download. I bought Parasite Eve off of it, Tomba, a few others. God. I know they have a lot of the older Shin Megami Tensei games up on there. And a lot of that stuff is very expensive. I know one game, Radiant Silver Gun and Ikaruga, something like that, they're going for I remember seeing for $100, $200 back in the day.
Same with Tomba. Now, if you want a good copy of it, you need to pay $170 just for disc, I think. Mm-hmm. And that's just for the disc. That doesn't include the book or the actual case it comes in. But, that's the thing is, those games are so old. That way, people, we should be able to have, copies of them to play. Mm-hmm. Because I want to play them, but, if I ask, the company, hey, you guys got a Tomba disc kicking around? Mm-hmm. I want to play it. They'd be no, crazy?
Yeah.
And then, but, But, like, you know, it's up on the store. That's fine. But, like, I would be fine if they even added, if it was, like, a subscription-based kind of thing, like $10 and you get access to all their previous consoles library. Like, think about that for Nintendo. Like, Game Boy Color, Advance, DS, and then there'd be Nintendo, Super Nintendo, 64, GameCube. Like, that would be amazing to have a chance again to play Super Mario Sunshine, like, even on the computer.
Yeah. And something tells me the computer with Nintendo, that I think may be a stretch. I know there are emulators. I know there's people who played Xenoblade Chronicles through, I think, the Dolphin emulator. I think that's what it's called.
It is Dolphin.
But as you said, there's definitely a market for these older titles. And this actually goes back to what I spoke with GOG.com on an interview a few months ago. I asked him specifically, why do you think people are drawn to these games? And he said they were developed during a time where people were allowed to basically make what they want without having to deal with public testing, focus groups, stuff like that. So you got a very clean or clear vision of what the developer had in mind. And this goes for pretty much any time entertainment medium, that some of the best stuff were made specifically at that time. They really couldn't be made, you know, 10 years further or 5 years further because the time and the mindset are different.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, I think, in my opinion, when we switched over, like when Nintendo switched over from GameCube to the Wii, that was pretty much the downfall of the company right there. Because that's when it got, my opinion, it cared. It really started to care about, like, consumer markets, even though the GameCube still lacked some great titles from Japan. Like, we still got a lot of them, probably a lot more ratio-wise than the Wii ever did. And it's just a shame. Like, I don't know, I'm a big fan of, like, everyone having access to stuff like this, like literature, art, music, movies, and I just feel like video games, like, They're also potentially missing out on a great market as well. Like they could still make money off of this. Throw up like the old games for like $2 a title or something, and you get the rights to play it. Like,
now Nintendo does have that on both the Wii U and the 3DS. They do have the Virtual Console, the eShop store. You can buy these older titles, but not everything is on there. It's not like GOG where you have this, you know, incredibly expansive library of games from 15 plus years ago. They have been cherry picking their titles. I know it took them years to get Earthbound on the Virtual Console, and we still haven't seen Mother 3 or the sequel to Earthbound released in any form in the US. And I know there are guys ranting and raving to get Nintendo to do that. Same thing with Xenoblade Chronicles. I still can't imagine them saying, we don't want this game ported over, when it was considered one of the best Wii titles pretty much for the entire run of the console.
Yeah, they just, like, I feel like Nintendo has, like, no idea what they're doing half the time.
Yeah.
Like, with this Amiibo stuff, like, I still feel like they have no idea what they're doing.
I mean, I do have to give Nintendo credit. They are pretty much one of the few major developers who pretty much do what they want. They have that cloud, they have their own platform, so they can't get away with stuff that Microsoft and Sony couldn't. But as we've said on previous casts, there is little doubt in my mind that Nintendo will not be able to get to a number one console for a long time. They just don't have what people want on it. So they really need to focus on making it stand out as much as they can so that it becomes like the number two choice.
Yeah, but it just sucks. It's not going to happen anytime right now.
Now, before I go into the next point, I just want to state for the record that Lorson just said the, you know, the old, you know, people your age response to me. So now I feel even older. So thank you, Lorson, for that.
Well, there's about a 10-year gap between us, so.
Yeah. I'm so old, and I'm going to be 30 in February. Well,
congratulations, old man. You made it.
Yeah, I'm ready. Now, getting back to game preservation, I want to play devil's advocate for a second, and I want to ask you, see what you think about this, Lorson.
Okay.
One of the things about game design is that it is an ever-evolving thing, and a lot of the older games, and this is stuff that I see on GOG and just on Nintendo, a lot of it really doesn't hold up well. Like, we talked about this on previous casts, like, a lot of the old-school computer RPGs, I'm talking like Might and Magic 1, Ultima, stuff like that, for someone new going back to play that, it's pretty much, you know, a torture to try to sit through and try to learn those games. So, for you, Lorson, regarding that, what do you think about the concept that about a lot of these games really don't hold up well? And that is one of the common defenses of people's lack of interest in game preservation or backwards compatibility.
I think that's dumb. You should still preserve it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I go back to play Ape Escape on the PlayStation 1, and that game was eating up way too much RAM for that the thing even had. Like, there'd be times where the game would just slow down. Like, it would slow down so bad, it'd be a second before you would hear his foot, like, step hit the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, I don't care. I still want them. Like, mm-hmm. like they don't, just because the Mona Lisa has, like, a scratch on it doesn't mean they're going to throw it in the garbage and stop caring about it. And mm-hmm. that's my opinion about this, too. Like,
mm-hmm.
who cares? Like, think of all the old movies we still release on DVD that are horrible and should literally just be destroyed for mankind's interest. But they're still mm-hmm. there. We still got to keep our stuff, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yep, and I said this on a previous cast, but one of my favorite TV shows is The Twilight Zone from 1957. To 1967, 1968. So, I mean, that's a show that, you know, it's well past its prime, but I still love watching it.
Yeah, and some of the, like, I've seen that, and, like, some of it's good, but some of it is, like, horrible. Like, just some of the shows, like, they just still look bad, and
yeah.
that, like, it's still around. I mean, it just proves my point a little bit better. Just because mm-hmm. it's bad doesn't mean we gotta get rid of it.
Mm-hmm. Now, with the game industry, part of the problem, and this is another thing I talk with GOG about, is licensing. A lot of the older studios aren't around anymore, and the IP basically got booed to whatever company or individual bought them out or bought after the company went bankrupt. So a lot of it can become challenging to get the rights to it. And we talked about this before the cast, with the whole Rockstar Studios issue with them licensing music, and they had to... they changed the game and got rid of some songs. This is another thing that a lot of older games have. Like with Farsight, the guys who did the pinball arcade, for instance, when they licensed a pinball, like a popular arcade machine like Terminator 2, Adam's Family, Twilight Zone, whatever, not only do you have to get the license for the board itself, you get the license for the graphics, you get the license to any of the actors or whoever owns their likeness or lets them like appear on like video games or whatever, they have to get a cut of the money. So there's a lot of legal issues when you're dealing with licensing characters or popular IPs. And this is another one of the major stumbling blocks with game preservation and keeping these games going, is that it can become a nightmare both financially and legally to get everything you need to say, okay, now people can download ActRaiser or Ape Escape on a new console or a new digital platform.
Yeah, why not? Why not?
Yep.
I'm just getting upset about it. It's all like I just wish I had access to all this old stuff that I never got a chance to play.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but back in like 1998, I actually sold my NES to get the Sega Dreamcast, thinking that, you know, we would still be able to play these games at some point. Now, it is just a pain in the ass to get them. And I know probably the first thing I'm going to do when I get a Wii U is go on and just binge by a lot of the old NES Virtual Console stuff that's up there.
That, all right, now that we're talking about the Nintendo thing again, one point I want to make out of why Nintendo system, of why I still don't agree with them, is that it's bound to the physical block that rests inside your home, not like an account or anything.
Mm-hmm.
It is a downfall.
Yep, and that's one of the big shifts in terms of the game industry, is the whole digital account scheme. I mean, we've talked at length about our love for Steam, and part of that has been, yes, we have given up physical copies, but at the same time, I have, you know, 800 games in a library attached to an online account where I can download and play them all without any trouble, as opposed to, imagine if I had 800 boxes of games, you know, lined up here. We need, like, a small storage unit to hold all the games I bought on Steam.
Right, exactly.
And Nintendo, this has been another one of the issues Nintendo has had, is that they are very slow to make, like, these grand changes. I mean, Microsoft and Sony relatively quickly have their online networks, you know, Xbox Live, PSN, and they've had value attached to it. They have your accounts. You know, we have Steam, Origin, Uplay, even GOG.com has a way for you to have all these games attached to your account and give you, I guess, quote-unquote virtual ownership. Now, it's important to mention with GOG, even though they are a digital service, they have no basically claim to your copy. So if you download a game from GOG, it's your copy to do whatever the hell you want with it, and they can't touch it. Whereas on Steam or Origin, they can update the online version, which then updates your hard drive version.
Which GOG has a better thing, but you could also say Steam does too, or the other ones do. I don't know how I feel. I don't know how I feel about it, because like, you might want updates if the game's broken, but not necessarily. But I also I'm also a big thing of like once you buy it, you own it. It's not, that's not for discussion, even if it is like a digital thing. But that could be me and just involved with all like that Linux stuff. Like the whole, like all the arguments about that. I always like try to drag it into everything else.
And that's the big debate with digital is who owns these copies. Like with Steam, if Steam decides to get rid of a game on a store, or if they decide that they can't sell a game, do they have the right to remove it from your library? Now, technically with Steam, you don't own any of your games. You own the license. So there's always that little, you know, gray area of who, what will happen to these games, you know, as years and years go on. As we've seen with EA, they are not, they're not really popular with preserving their games. They've, you know, removed whole online support, and that just basically guts a lot of their titles. And it's also a lot harder to find some of their games, like Battle for Middle-earth 2. Of course, there's the whole SimCity debacle, which they finally, after, you know, a year of people complaining, say, oh, now you can play it offline. So it's really hard to say, you know, easily where ownership of these titles come from when you have a developer who can basically say, oh, we're going to change the game now. And we talked about this briefly with Payday 2, and after a year and a half, we talked about this before the cast, they've, you know, completely redid their skill trees. So the whole game is completely different. So that whole foundation that people have been used to is now gone. And on one hand, that's great because it means the game evolves. But on the other hand, it means that, you know, what people have been used to, the rug's been pulled out from under them.
Yep, agreed.
And you were also talking about this before the cast with Team Fortress and how they've altered a lot of the standard items design.
Oh, they tried to. And the biggest one they didn't get away with, because I know a lot of people put in bug tickets for it after the update, and then they had to revert it, and some of the other ones stayed, which wasn't necessary. Like, none of those updates were necessary, especially after, like, 6 long years of this game. You don't need to update your stock and your, you don't need to update your stock items, you don't need to update your base things. The only thing that should be fixed is bugs, nothing else at this point. Like, you've done the damage, and if when you have something set so in place like that, like, as some people probably complain about, like, a meta, like, you can't just, like, be like, oh, well, this has been going along for 6 years, well, I guess you don't get your attack power anymore, and, like, you cut it in half. Like, it doesn't make sense, especially when there's, like, established, like, leagues and stuff. Like, I mean, there's not, like, that in Payday, but, like, when we have, but, like, with Payday, it was just at the year mark, so my opinion is you have a year to kind of, like, fix your game and get everything balanced out. And that's kind of like my rule of thumb for what is like a good update versus a really bad update, like what happened in TF2.
And this again goes back, we can actually take this back to the issue of backwards compatibility and game preservation, that what happens when, you know, like the Wii Virtual Console, are they going to support this for, you know, the next 2-3+ console generations? What will happen to all these games that we bought? It's that same fear that a lot of critics had with Steam. You know, now, of course, the chance that Valve is going to go under at this point is pretty much ludicrous. But with a lot of other digital clients out there, what happens when a company goes out or for some reason they can't sell a game anymore, they don't have access to those titles? Should we expect developers to constantly keep updating these games? Like, for example, with Nintendo and the PSN, should we expect every new console have accommodations for playing these older titles? I'm betting that Lorson, you're going to say yes, but there's a lot of people out there who say no. I'd rather see them dedicate time and resources to new stuff.
Absolutely, because it can be as simple as having just a software that runs when those old games play. And in that case, you pretty much don't have to do anything to the console,
mm-hmm.
which, it's just as simple as downloading Dolphin onto my computer and playing a GameCube game. There's almost no setup to it.
Mm-hmm.
Just make sure everything's pulled out of the zip file.
Mm-hmm.
To me, that doesn't seem like such a big problem. Like, if you're going to make a new console, have new things, just have it so that there's, a retro mode or something, and you can play all those things. Yes, you are correct.
I think you just made a really good point, Morrison, about having emulator software, because that is one of the sticking points. With the PlayStation 3 and Nintendo Wii and stuff like that, they actually had to design the systems to accept those older discs, to accept those older formats, and basically scale down to play them. But if there was emulator software, if someone did design almost like a universal software that lets you run NES, and whatever games, then as you said, it's not about making the system hardware compliant, it's about just letting it accept or have that software installed and letting it use that as opposed to additional system power and technology.
Yeah, it's a simple fix.
Yeah. And I know Sony has been working with the studio, I think Genkai, on having that kind of streaming service so that basically the server would run the older emulation and you would just basically play the game through that, as opposed to them designing the hardware and the core systems to run these older games. And I think that is a good point and maybe where we will see backwards compatibility come in. Because as we've said, with how fast the industry is moving, it's only a matter of time for someone to maybe be able to create that universal emulator software. And who knows, maybe Nintendo will be the one to do it with their system and their older games.
And that, in my opinion, would be a great start for them. For a long road of recovery between the two of us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's kind of interesting. I know you said this earlier in the cast regarding having these older games for younger generations. And that is one of the things that I feel strongly about as well with game preservation. And I know there's a lot of people who also side with us on that you really can't play some of these older games anymore, both in terms of design and availability. I mean, a game like Toomba, I love that game. But again, it died after the second game, so there's no more examples of that specific title. Same goes for Parasite Eve, games like Blast Corps or N64. I mean, I could sit here for the next 2 hours and just ramble off the entire list of older games. But this, again, goes back to the popularity that you can't play these games anymore. They were developed with a very specific mindset at a very specific period of the game industry. And earlier in the cast, when I brought up Skylanders and Star Control 2, Star Control 2 is another example of that. It's one of my all-time favorite games, but they're not making any more of that title at the moment, so your only option is to play the original. And thankfully, it's one of the games on GOG.com. And another example would be XCOM. Now, XCOM is considered one of the all-time greatest PC games, but after a few titles in the series, it pretty much died until Firaxis basically revised it for a modern audience. But that's a rare exception. We're not seeing developers every day take classic games and reviving them.
That's true. There's a lot of them just tend to stay dead. Or
mm-hmm.
The only company that actually seems to do it at all would be Nintendo, when they occasionally release a new Zelda game on a handheld, with the Ocarina of Time and now Majora's Mask coming out.
Yeah, and that's great that they're using those old series, but it's not the same as basically having it universally available, so that if I buy off their virtual console, I could have it, on all my Nintendo-related platforms. Here, I'm just basically buying a new version that's then locked to this current gen.
Yeah, exactly, and that's what's, and that's always been my main problem and my main, one of my big points when I talk about, preserving video games, at all, is that, when we have new ones come out, disc or whatever, that's it. It just works with that disc, and then it has to work with the appropriate console, which then you have to keep around. And if you want to play it, I play Tales of Symphonia every summer, so mm-hmm. I need to have my disc, I need to have both of them, and then I need to have a memory card, and then I need to have either a Wii or a GameCube.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to keep that around, because that's just a tradition that I do, and... Mm-hmm. It's much easier if it's preserved somewhere else, or more easily accessed than having to keep this like older technology where like some monitors now and some screens like don't even have those inputs anymore. Yeah.
And that's another great point. I mean, I saw my Super Nintendo sort of like haphazardly hooked up to my HD TV. And, you know, that's not going to be a permanent solution.
How'd you do? Is that through cable, right?
Yeah.
Cable link.
Yeah, the cable link. I have the HD line for my cable TV, and now I have the basic cable link to the just to the Super Nintendo. But as you said, Larson, a lot of older technology is phased out. That's the nature of technology. You know, we're not using cell phones that are like 10 pounds anymore. We got smartphones, computers are more powerful, but a lot of the older stuff, it reaches a point where it's just not possible to port it. And bringing us back to GOG, they said that basically anything pre-Windows, so DOS era, is almost impossible to run these days just because there's no modern equivalent to, you know, DOS. And I never want to go back to DOS ever again.
Yep. no one does at this point.
That's another criticism of backwards compatibility is that a lot of people don't want to play these older games. They're happy with modern titles, modern design sensibilities. And again, going back to Might and Magic, I don't see a modern fan, someone who loves Mass Effect, Elder Scrolls, etc., would be so willing to have any interest in playing Might and Magic 1 with, you know, just a keyboard UI and just very confusing graphics.
Mm-hmm.
But it's, again, one of those very interesting arguments. But I think the point that we've made about if they do develop a software as opposed to a hardware solution, that would go a long way to making it easier to keep these games supported.
Exactly. Absolutely. Sorry, I'm really bad at just agreeing with you and not not just leaving you hanging. I just say, yep, but, yeah, no, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
Now, another point that I want to touch on before we wrap up is regarding game collectability. Now, we talked about this a few minutes ago with you, Orson, regarding, like, trying to get a copy of, like, Toomba or Apescape these days. I mean, these discs can go for $100, $200. Because people are trying to create a collectible market for the game industry, much in the same way there's a collectible market for cars, for art, for antiques, etc. But with the video game industry, it's different. That one, a lot of our stuff is purely interactive, so it's not really the disc that we care about, the physical object, what's on there. And second is the fact that we still have developers trying to make these games backwards compatible. So while someone is trying to sell a copy of Toomba for, you know, $150, $200, I can go on, you know, the PSN, spend $5, and it's mine. So for you, Larson, what do you think about the video game industry having a collectible market? Do you think it's possible, or do you think it's just too, I guess, incompatible with how game design works?
And you mean that in the sense people like physically collecting consoles and games and the accessories that go along with them?
Yep, and trying to basically create a buying and selling market like we see with cars and other stuff.
Well, at first I used to be a really big fan of it, and part of it where I'd go around and just try to get all the, like, these titles that I was mostly I was just collecting stuff that I wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And as I started to see people's collections, and as I was trading with people who had like rooms or rooms in their house dedicated to video games, I kind of came to kind of realize that it's not necessarily something that, like, I kind of agree with, mostly for the sole fact that if I want something, I already know for a fact that there's a lot of people out there who have a copy that they're never gonna trade or get rid of.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm not gonna try to sound like a hypocrite here like two other times. So game collecting is great because there's some people who will take care of it and they will literally treasure what they have because it's a part of history. Because no matter what, if video games were to die out within the next 10 years, they would still look back on it in the span of like 20, 30 years of video games. And it will be like, this was a crazy time where these people just sat down at a computer and played with pixels and stuff, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And it's important to preserve that. Like, I've seen people who've had complete collections of consoles, including like their special editions released only in certain countries. And it is beyond breathtaking because you would never expect to see something like that. So while it's it's really not meant for everybody. It's really meant for someone who's going to be passionate about it and keep everything safe.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm 100% for it.
Okay.
That means I can't get what I want.
And it's kind of interesting. I'm sort of on the opposite end of that because I have limited space here. So I can't really go the full collector. As we said, playing a video game is not just about owning the disc. You need the hardware. You need the hookups. You need something that's able to support that. So there's a mm-hmm. lot more work that goes into it as opposed to cars. Now, obviously, cars are a lot more money. That's easy to say. But the support is there to build a car. I mean, someone with enough time and money can build a car from 1950, 1960, and then use it pretty well. It's not like, imagine if gasoline, they changed, you know, how gasoline works. And that from now on, they're only selling gasoline that works for cars from the year 2004. That would kill that collectible market. With the video game industry, as we said, technology really has a way of killing itself. We're not using, you know, cable hookups anymore. Eventually, you know, with DVDs and Blu-rays, there will probably be a new format that will make those obsolete. And then how will we be able to use DVDs in, like, 15, 20 years from now?
Especially as the Blu-ray market gets more aggressive and they start offering backwards compatibility.
Mm-hmm. Yep, so the market, going back to the video game industry, it's just a very interesting time because of the fact that we are moving so fast. I mean, the last, well, we could say maybe 7-8 years since Steam has become the juggernaut that it is, that the market has just radically shifted towards digital means and online accessibility, and that has sort of gone hand-in-hand with the increase in internet. I mean, again, I get to sound old to young Larson over here, but I remember dial-up modems, the evil that was, and then we went to basic DSL, and then broadband. I mean, I remember when internet speeds were, you know, like maybe 30, 40 kilobytes. And now I just did a speed test with my internet service. I have almost 30 meg download speeds. And I still remember the day that I got cable modem for the first time. And just, I click on website and it loads up in 10 seconds and not, you know, 2 minutes.
And those were dark days.
That was the dark ages for us. But again, this goes back to how technology moves forward. And if we're not careful, and if we don't start taking a lot more guidelines towards preservation, it will become a point where a lot of stuff will just simply just fade off into obscurity.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And that's also a big stance on my, on why we need to preserve everything. Because you don't want to lose this. Like, I don't want to ever lose, like, Super Mario World 3 for Super Nintendo or any of my games for the 64 or the GameCube. I'm gonna get the urge to go back and play them.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, if I ever had kids, I would totally want them to have the experience too.
Mm-hmm. I think going back to experience them is an interesting point. Because, I mean, I do it with a lot of my older titles as well. I've played Killer 7 now, like, 10 different times. I have, you know, the Mega Man collection. I play that often. And I know you mentioned it earlier with, you know, Super Mario Sunshine. That game, I think, is going for like $100, $200, you know, on Amazon. And it's a great Mario game, but again, it's just hard to find some of these titles. And again, you just don't need the title. You need the hardware, the hookup, etc. So I think we are sort of repeating our points, but we definitely need to see greater steps taken towards game preservation to keep, you know, the history of the game industry intact.
Mm-hmm.
I think with that, I think we're starting to get to the point where we're sort of repeating our points. So I think we can start wrapping things up. Unless there's any other topics you want to bring up regarding backwards compatibility or collectible games.
No, that's pretty much all I have to say. At this point, I'm kind of repeating myself.
Yeah. I think it's interesting that we're both hardened supporters of backwards compatibility. So we are sort of talking in an echo chamber.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
There's nothing else to say. Yeah. There's nothing else to say. I like beating a dead horse. It's my favorite thing to do.
I think with that, we're going to wrap things up. So I guess my final point on backwards compatibility is that I am definitely a supporter of it. I think Larson made a really great point about the fact that perhaps if we do figure out a solution to make a universal emulator through software, as opposed to hardware, that would make things a hell of a lot easier to preserve backwards compatibility. I know GOG has been, you know, working hard at figuring out ways to get these older games to work on modern software. I would love, you know, my dream idea would be for GOG to team up with Nintendo and work with them on creating a software solution to it. But I don't know if that will ever happen.
Nintendo will never team up with another company, like, ever.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, we could probably spend two more hours on that one sentence right there.
I always have fighting words, always.
So I guess with that, what's your final thoughts, Larson, on the matter?
We need backwards compatibility and we need to preserve the history.
Awesome. All right. I think with that said, we can wrap up this cast. So again, thank you for listening to the cast. And Larson, it was a pleasure having you on and talking with me for the last, I guess, it's just about 2 hours now.
Oh my God. Yes, it is. It's been great. I love getting into these discussions with you.
Yep, and I love having them. With that said, as always, for those of you listening, if you would like to contribute to Game Wisdom, we have several options available. For being a future podcast guest or writing a guest piece for the site, you can find all the information and links under Submission Wanted on the front page. And to contribute to our Patreon campaign for funding for Game Wisdom, you can find all the information for that under the Patreon banner, also on the front page. So, again, thank you for listening to the Percepta podcast. By the time you hear this, it will probably be Monday, so have a great rest of the week, and we will talk to you again next time. Take care.